So this week, we're talking Vayishlach. There's so much in Vayishlach. I sat there trying to figure out which part of the parsha I wanted to tackle, and I thought maybe Dina, and then I thought maybe Yaakov fighting with the Malach, but then settled on Yaakov's encounter with Esav, and you have, as usual, the psukim there at the top. And what I want to look at are some key questions about this meeting between Yaakov and Esav. Questions that come up a lot that you sort of have to ask when you're reading through the parsha, but that we often don't actually have real answers for. So, looking at the psukim themselves, remember the story. Yaakov has been in the house of his cousin Lavan. That didn't go so well, but he emerged from there safe. He emerged from there with a family, and he's now headed back to Israel and looking for trouble. And that's something to remember throughout this story, is that Yaakov is looking for trouble. And I say that because, really, this whole encounter with Esav doesn't have to happen. Right? The encounter doesn't have to happen. Yaakov knows that Esav wants to kill him. That's the last information he had from 20 years earlier. And he could just come back into the land and go to his father's house. But he doesn't. Instead, we're told by Yishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav, Esav Achiv. Yaakov sent angels to his brother Esav. It's not quite clear why he thinks this is a good idea. Maybe he thinks, well, let me get it out of the way. Maybe he thinks Esav is going to be hanging around with his father anyway, because Esav, of course, we know, is the expert in Kibbutz Avim, and therefore Esav is going to be somewhere nearby anyway, so he wants to do it that way. Maybe his hope is actually to send his scouts and find out ahead what's going on and see if he can avoid Esav or if Esav has calmed down. But Yaakov goes looking for Esav. The Malachim come back and say, well, we went to your brother Esav and he's coming to greet you and he has 400 men with him. And Yaakov comes to the logical conclusion that that's probably not the welcome party. I just thought I'd gather 400 of my closest friends to go meet you. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. So Yaakov thinks, okay, there really is trouble, and he prepares for trouble with the classic three methods. Number one, he presents a gift, right, the bribe. Number two, in no particular order, but number two, he splits the camp in half, or I should say he says he's going to split the camp in half. We're going to revisit that. But he says, I'm going to split the camp in half so that if the first part gets attacked, then the second part can at least run away. And he davens to Hashem and says, remember that little promise of protection? Right? This would be a good time for me to invoke that. And those are his three methods of preparing for Esav. Then he has this little encounter with a malach, or we think it's a malach. The Torah doesn't say it's a malach. The Torah simply says ish. A man fought with him, which may lead me to think it's just a regular wrestling match until Yaakov goes and asks him for a bracha, which, you know, if you get mugged in the middle of the night, generally speaking, you don't go to the mugger and say, so by the way, can I have a bracha? And the mugger says to him, okay, what's your name? My name is Yaakov. Oh, well, now your name is Yisrael. Also not the sort of thing that happens, you know, when you've been attacked. So that's part of what leads us to believe there's something more going on here. As we'll see, one approach, an approach shared by Ibn Ezra and others, is that this is meant to be a sort of a pep rally type of a thing for Yaakov, that he should feel good coming into encountering Esav. Look at that, I survived one battle, I can survive another battle. That's one way to look at it. Others look at it as this is somebody representing Esav, someone who's hostile and actually trying to harm him. But we'll see that. After the battle with this Malach, this mysterious being, we have the encounter between Yaakov and Esav. Take a look, please, at Pasuk Aleph. Vayisa Yaakov Einav. Yaakov raised his eyes. Vayar vihine Esav ba. And he saw, guess what? Here's Esav coming. V'imo arbameos ish, and the promised 400 men are there with him. V'yachas es hayeladim al Leah v'al Rachel v'al shtei ha-shefachot. So he divided up the kids with Leah, Rachel, and the two shefachot. A couple of things that you really should note here. First of all, v'yisa Yaakov einav. That's an odd phrase. Right? Usually we would just say, v'yar. Right? And Yaakov saw. Vayar Yaakov, perhaps. Yaakov raised his eyes is an interesting turn of phrase. If you take a look beneath the psukim, but above that table, you see those psukim I referenced? Those are all references where we see someone is nosei einav before this in the Torah. It's not a rare phrase. Vayisa so-and-so enav. However, it's a phrase that is consistent in its meaning. Whether it's Vayisa lot et enav, Lot raised up his eyes when he was fleeing from Sodom, and he raised up his eyes and saw that there was a place there that he could run to and survive. Or whether it's Vayisa Avraham et enav, Avram raises up his eyes when he's sitting at the entrance to the tent and he sees the travelers. Or whether it's the interesting linking of Yitzchak looks up, he raises his eyes and he sees Rivka coming back with Eliezer, and Rivka raises her eyes and sees Yitzchak out in the field. It's always an expression of looking with confidence or with anticipation. It's something optimistic. Which is kind of odd when you think about the way that Yaakov has been anticipating this meeting. Right? Yaakov is dreading this meeting. So how do we understand this sudden confidence or anticipation when he raises his eyes and he sees, oh great, Esav. Your turn. What do we make of this? Why is Yaakov suddenly confident?
Well, he's prepared himself in a way. It's not a surprise.
Right.
Because he had warning that this was what was going to be, so he could plan. And when you know something might even be challenging, if you know what that is, you can go into it with confidence.
And it goes back to that idea of Ibn Ezra on the fight with the Malach. It's a confidence builder. You know, he's very agitated and nervous until then because he's never fought for his life before. Granted that he did battle with Lavan, but it was an entirely different type of battle. Right? Lavan was a mind game. Esav is a murderer. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but that's his reputation. The Esav is the one who goes out hunting and trapping and is here with his 400 men. And Yaakov's, you know, looking at this and thinking, my God, what in the world am I going to do? How am I going to survive this? But then he has a wrestling match and he succeeds. And he says, oh, I can do this too. And you'll see how that plays out in the dialogue between him and Esav. Yaakov is not coming into this afraid. Yaakov is coming into this with a feeling of confidence and anticipation. The Nitziv has a similar take on this. Notice also, though, what he does with his family. What does he do there? Vayachas es hayeladim. He split the kids. Leah, Rachel, and the two Shefachot. Who are the two Shefachot?
Bilhah
and Zilpah. Why are they Shefachot? Weren't they wives? They originally were Shefachot. They started out that way. But at some point they became his wives. They married him. I mean, their kids are considered to be, you know, Shvatim. Why are we identifying them suddenly as Shefachot? Later on in the Torah, they won't be Shefachot. They'll be described as Nashim, Nashay Yaakov. An odd term to use. Unfortunately, you're not going to like the answer, but take a look at Pasuk Bed, and I think it'll be clear. Vayasem es hashvachos ves yaldehen rishona. He put the maids and their kids first. Ves leyavi ladeha acharonim. Leah and her kids after that. Ves Rachel ves Yosef acharonim. And then Rachel and Yosef last. What's he doing?
Prioritizing.
Well, prioritizing favoritism in the sense that this is the first line, and if Esav attacks them, the rest can get away. And the Mefarshim look at that and just present it as is, like they don't even blink. Like, oh yeah, it's these are the ones who he cares least about. It's an incredibly harsh thing to see, but it seems like there really was a different. There was a different relationship here. Which I think is very hard for us to sort of process. In my world, this doesn't exist.
It's like no one idea, thing you can maybe say about the wives, but another thing about the children.
Yeah.
Right? Like, at the end of the day, it's your child.
Right.
Whether it was your favorite wife or not, you know?
Right. The problem that he faces is that he doesn't have options. What are his choices? Someone has to go first, and he has to choose which one is going to go first.
Maybe he thought these other wives were stronger. They came from a, you know, different background if they were, you know, originally the helpmates, right? Maybe he thought they were tougher and they could stand up better.
I wouldn't mess with Rachel, I have to tell you. But in terms of, there's the measure that they're sisters, which is a whole other dimension to this. But in terms of like two of the sisters being the wives and two of the sisters being the shvachot, that's a very difficult dynamic. But the idea here seems to be that he has to prioritize. He doesn't have a choice, and he says, these are going to be the ones, as shvachot, they're going to be the first line, because he really doesn't have any other possibility. He has no other way to do this. But it does carry over into the future. If you remember the beginning of Parashat Vayeshev, the rift between Yosef and his brothers that leads ultimately to his sale, the Torah there says that Yosef was v'hu na'ar, he was a young man, es b'nei Bilha v'es b'nei Zilpa nishay aviv, with the children of Bilha and Zilpah, his father's wives. Now it says wives there rather than shvachot, but it begs the question, why is Yosef hanging out specifically with Bilha and Zilpah's kids? And so there's a debate between Rashi and Ramban about it, but one view there is that Yosef is with Bilha and Zilpah's kids because they are being shunned by the children of Leah, who say, well, you're from the shvachot. And you see the seeds of it right here. I'm not maligning Yaakov, and I'm not trying to put guilt on Yaakov. I don't. It's very dangerous for someone today to read a couple of stories in Tanakh and decide that he's a psychologist and that he can tell you everything about the people who lived then. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's presenting has a very marked effect here, putting the shvachot first and their kids first, and putting the rest of them afterwards. And the Mefarshim will say it. I'm not inventing it. That this is, you know, this is the goal. The goal is, well, if they get hurt, the others can flee. V'hu avar lifnehem. Note that Yaakov is the one who goes first. Yaakov passes in front of them. Vayishtachu arza shava pe'amim ad gishto ad ochiv. And he bows to the ground 7 times until he finally reaches his brother. For all of his confidence, he's still displaying the utmost humility before his brother, which is a theme we're going to come back to. Vayaratz Esav likraso vayechabkehu. Esav runs to him and he hugs him. Vayipol al tzavara vayishakehu. He falls on his throat and he kisses him. Vayivku, and they cry. We have to come back to that sentence. There's a lot going on there. Vayisayas einav. He, Esav, raises his eyes. Vayaras Hanashim Bes Hayeladim, and what does he see? Where Yaakov raised up his eyes and saw Esav with 400 men, Esav sees the wives and Esav sees the kids. Vayomer mi elalach, and he says, who are these people to you? And we have to understand better what exactly it is that he's asking here. Vayomar, and he said, Hayeladim Asher Hanan Elokim Es Abdecha. These are the children who God gave as a gift, Hanan like Chonen, to give graciously, that Hashem gave to Abdecha, your servant. One of several times we're going to see Yaakov refer to himself as the servant of Esav. But there's something wrong with Yaakov's answer. What was the question? What did Esav ask him?
Who are these people to you?
Who are these people to you? Who's Esav describing?
The wives and the children.
The wives and the children. And what does Yaakov answer?
The answer is about the children.
Right. Didn't mention the wives at all. What happened? Why doesn't he mention the wives?
Well, sometimes it's an inference, like, you've got kids, you've got a wife, right?
Right, so these are my wives.
Package, right?
Right.
Like,
so,
it's like, you know, the grandchildren don't, you know, the parents are just a vehicle for, right, bringing the grandchildren.
Right. So the Malbim actually says that with a twist. He says, Esav is puzzled to see Yaakov with 4 wives. Esav says, wait, I was the wild one. You are the Ishtam. Yeah. How did you end up with 4 wives? And that's the way Malbim reads it. And so his response is, well, you see all these kids? And yes, by inference, those are the mothers of his children. He's saying, yeah, I married these women. That's his answer. Ramban suggests that it's actually Musar. It's rebuke. He's saying to him, you shouldn't be asking about the wives. He says, you want to ask me about the kids? I'll tell you all about the kids. But that's it. That's where he's drawing the line. So says Ramban.
Could he be afraid that Esau would be taking the wives, like Avram lied about being sisters. So
he's concerned about Esau's morality. Well, has he solved the problem by not mentioning them at all? Or is he just saying, like Ramban says, I'm setting them off limits, sort of, like as a warning to Esau.
He's avoiding being evasive about it because he doesn't trust Esau.
Right. Could be. Certainly fits with the story that we know of with Yosef and Rachel, which is coming next. In Pasuk Vav, Vatigashna Shpachot, Heina Vialdehen, Vatishtachavena, the maids go forward with their kids, they bow. Vatigash Gamle Avil Adeva Ishtachavu, Leah and her kids went and bowed. Vachar Nigash Yosef, Rachel Vaishtachavu, and then Yosef and Rachel went and bowed. And the famous point here, what happened, what's the difference between the way Yosef and Rachel go and the way the others go? Yosef is mentioned by name because he's the only one. Unlike the others, Rachel only has one kid at this point. But what's different about the way Yosef goes and the way the others go?
Yosef is mentioned first.
Right, Yosef is first. In the other cases, it's the mother and then the kids. Yosef goes first, and the Medrash says Yosef is trying to defend his mother. Yosef is all of, we don't know how old, but he can't be older than a couple of years at this stage. Nonetheless, Yosef is already, putting himself in front. He's very protective of Rachel. So that would also fit with this idea that Esav is still seen as something of a threat. So Esav now gives you his second question. Esav likes to ask questions. In Pasuk Hey, he asked, what is all this, or who are all these people to you? Now in Pasuk Chet, he says, Mi lecha kol ha-machane hazeh asher pagashti. Those words are odd words to translate. We're going to have to come back to them. But who is this to you, all this camp that I've encountered? And Esav says, Yaakov says, I should say, Vayomer, Lum tzochein b'nei Adoni, we want to find favor in the eyes of my master. In other words, I sent you, not these people, but the whole gift that I sent before, the goats, the camels, the whole bit, in order to find favor in your eyes. In other words, it's a present. I'm sending you a gift, he says. Vayomer Esav, but Esav says, come on. Yeshli Rav, he says, I have a lot already. Achi, my brother, Yehi Lecha Asher Lach, you can keep what you have. Esav declines, and in the politest way possible, right? He says, you're my brother. I'm gonna take your wealth. You get to keep it. Vayomer Yaakov, but Yaakov declines. He says, no. Al na im na matzasi chen beinecha. He says, no, please. He says, not twice here. Granted, one of them might mean now, but I don't think it reads right. I think they're both please. If I find favor in your eyes, v'lakachta min chasi miyadi, please take my present off of my hands. Ki'alkein ra'isi panecha kiros pnei Elokim v'atir tzeini. Very odd phrase. I have seen your face. It's like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. That's an odd phrase. Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. Right? In general, I want to come back and ask a few questions, but that's a key one that we have to examine. Kachno is birchasi. Yaakov continues at length here. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Take my blessing, meaning this gift, asher huvaslach, which has been brought to you. Ki chanani elokim, God has given me a lot. V'chiyeshli kol, I have everything. Vayiftzar bo vayikach, and he continued to push. Yaakov continued to push and say, take the gift, this really matters to him. And finally, vayikach, Esav took it. And then we get to the last part, Pasuk Yud Bet. We have the greeting, we have the quarrel over whether he's taking the present, not taking the present, and now we have the future. Vayomer nis'av ben eilecha. He said, let's travel. Ve'alchal negdecha. He, meaning Esav, said, let's go forward, and ve'alchal negdecha. I will travel opposite you. Esav says, let's join forces. He's so friendly. Right? I mean, this for the woman who came out with 400 men. Vayomer eilav, and Yaakov says, nah. Adoni yodea keila dimrakim. He says, my master knows the kids are very soft, still they're young. Vatzon rabakar alos alai. I have all this cattle, and they're all going to give birth to their young. Udfakum yom echad vamesu kol atzon. I'm going to push them to travel quickly to keep up a pace with you, and they're all going to die. Yavar na adoni lifnei avdo. Let my master travel in front of his servant me. Vani es naalali iti. I'm going to go slowly. L'regel ha-melacha she'lefanai, at the pace of the work that I have before me, meaning taking care of the cattle, l'regel ha-yeladim, the pace of the kids, ad asher avo el adoni se'ira, until I come to my master to Seir. right? Say here being, presumably, Esav's residence. We're going to come back to that. That's not so clear. Vayomer Esav, Esav said, Atzigana imcham in ha'am asher iti. Esav says, listen, I hear you. You need a slower pace. So I'm going to abandon my whole crew, and I'll go with you. Please let me join you. Vayomer, and he said, Lama ze emtzachin b'nei Adoni, why would this find favor in the eyes of my master? No. Vayasha b'yamahu Esav ledarko Seira, and so Esav goes back to Seir. Okay. A lot to talk about here. First, going back to Pasuk Dalet, is the kiss for real? Is Esav really sincere? Is that legit? Especially because if you look in a Sefer Torah, you will find dots on top of the word Vayishakehu. And dots we consider to be a tip-off that something is wrong with this word. There's something up here. It's interesting. I once heard a speaker who was a scholar in ancient Near East text, and he claimed that perhaps scribes in the ancient Near East would put dots over a word to show they had added a letter or taken away a letter, and that's what it's about. But he couldn't for the life of him explain any of the appearances of dots in the Torah. In other words, that explanation, it doesn't actually suit the cases that you see where there are dots in the Torah. When we see dots, we generally assume the Torah is trying to tell you there's something odd here, something isn't right with this word. And it happens to be we have dots on Esav kissing Yaakov, and we have reason to wonder, is this really sincere? But taking a look at Pasuk He and Pasuk Chet, Esav asks questions where questions don't seem to belong. I mean, if he doesn't know each one individually, can he not figure out that this is Yaakov's family? I mean, the women with their kids, and they're right in front of Yaakov. They're behind Yaakov, I should say. He can't figure out that these are family. And everything else is already known to him as a gift. Remember Yaakov's message? When Yaakov assigned them to go to Esav, Yaakov said, okay, kiv gashcha Esav achi, when my brother Esav encounters you, and he's going to ask you, what are you, whose are you, you will tell him, la'avdachal Yaakov mencha hishlucha laduni la'esav. These are from your servant Yaakov, this is a gift sent to Esav. So it's crystal clear. Esav knows exactly what this is. So what does he mean when he asks this question? What exactly is Esav asking? What is this comparison to seeing God? When he says seeing you is like seeing God, and in particular, Pasuk Yud Aleph, to take a minute on that. He says, accept my bracha that is brought to you. The word bracha is a loaded word for Yaakov and Esav, right? He stole Esav's bracha. Take my bracha, which is brought to you. And he changes the term. What does Yaakov call the gift first? In Pasuk Yud.
Mincha.
Right? An offering. And now he suddenly changes it to a bracha. And, I mean, really, if you're Yaakov, that's the last word you should introduce into that conversation. And my bracha, which is brought to you, you know, from Esav's point of view, it's more like my bracha, which you stole, and you're now trying to make it up by giving me a little present. Right? That's a lot more like it from Esav's perspective. And Yaakov rejects Esav's offer. He rejects Esav's when Esav says, I don't want the gift, he says, you're taking the gift. And when Esav says, I want to travel with you, Yaakov says, no. Yaakov is clearly leery of Esav, that much we can figure out. But there may be something more going on here, beyond just the general fear of Esav
be that when Esav is asking about what is this, even though he knows, maybe he's saying, what is this all about? Not what is this, what are you giving me, but like, what's this all about?
Right.
And maybe Yaakov's answer is trying to make amends.
Right.
He's saying, here's my bracha, clearly using words that relate to the previous encounter that they had, but trying to do it in a positive way to make amends for what has happened.
Right. Now, I think that's the read. And we're going to see more about this as we go through the different mefarshim on the story, but I think that is the read. I don't think he's asking, what is this? Yeah, or who is this? I think he's asking, why is this? And it's important to know that in terms of just basic Hebrew, the word me, you know, we are conditioned from grade school, means who. right? And you have the song, Ani is me, and me is who, and all that, fine. But that's not what the word me means in Aramaic. The word me in Aramaic is a sort of catch-all question word, which can mean who, it can also mean what, and it can also mean why. And remember that Aramaic is a child language of Hebrew and Arabic. That's how Aramaic is produced in a lot of Semitic languages. So that when you look at it, you have to ask yourself, is this me what it usually means in Hebrew, or is this me what would later become in Aramaic, the why question? I think that's the answer. I think me here means why. I don't think me here means who at all. But we're going to see how the Mefarshim approach it, and without making the linguistics point, that's how they're going to see it. One more question on this. This business of Seir, does Yaakov ever actually go to Seir? That one of the stops we ever remember reading about for Yaakov? We did a cool thing with the kids once a few years ago. We set up in our house in Allentown, we set up a, you know, like the, it's called butcher paper, the long paper used for like wrapping paper for things, right? So we set up a map for them, and each week with the parsha, we sort of outlined where the elbows traveled. You know, for Sefer Bereishis. We tried it again for Bamidbar with the Midbar travels. It didn't work so well because, you know, each one had a different point of view about where each thing was. But it was an nice idea in theory for them to see it. And Seir wasn't anywhere on the map. Yaakov never goes to Seir. So is he lying when he says, "Oh, yeah, I'll get to you in Seir. Sure. See you eventually." What exactly is going on with this pledge that Yaakov makes? And what we're going to see is a conflict in the terms of the different explanations. And in particular, what we're going to see is that Rashi is going to do the same thing that he did to us last week. If you remember in discussion last week, Rashi quoted part of a Medrash and part of a Gemara. He's going to do it all over again this week in trying to address that issue. So to sandwich this down to five key questions, and that's what I made the table for. Number one, is Esav sincere when he makes all these offers and says, "No, keep the gift," and when he hugs him and all that? Number two, if Esav is sincere, and parenthetically, if Yaakov is confident, then why is Yaakov so obsequious that he has to keep saying, "My master," and bowing down and calling himself his servant? Number three, what's the back and forth about the gift? Number four, why does Yaakov say, "I'd rather not travel with you"? And finally, what's this line about Seir? So the truth is that we could save a lot of time by having you read the chart, but I want to go through it one by one in terms of the different approaches. Rashi's approach is indeed that Esav's emotion is real, which is a problem, because how can his emotion possibly be real? Esav hates Yaakov. Why should Esav have stopped hating Yaakov? When we last saw Esav, he wanted to kill him. What changed? The pattern.
I
thought Rashi said something bad that he was going to fight
him. Yeah, I remember him as a kid also. Rashi brings you multiple.
Marble,
right. No, the marble is Moshe. There is a medrash about Moshe's neck turning to marble, but there are a few midrashim on this, and Rashi brings multiple views. But the one that really caught my eye, take a look at source number one. Rashi quotes it, but here's the text from the original medrash. It says, "Vayishakeyu nakud alav." The word "vayishakeyu," and he kissed him, has das atop it, because he did not kiss Yaakov with all of his heart. Okay, that's the first view presented in the Medrash. It's to say it wasn't really sincere. Then Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai gives me another approach. He says it is known as halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. That's a whole other discussion of what that means when you say it's halacha. What law has any relevance to this, to this point? But he says it is known, halacha biyadua, Esav soneh Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov. But his mercies were reversed at that moment, and he kissed Yaakov with all of his heart. That was indeed sincere. Leaving Rashi to explain why. How did this happen? And so Rashi has an interesting suggestion. Rashi suggests that the Malachim who Yaakov sent roughed up Esav. That's the language that Esav understands. It's a language of force. So Rashi suggests maybe those Malachim had another role. Yes, their role was to greet Esav, but it was also to make Esav friendly. And that's the change in Esav. And that's Rashi's approach there. And so he says, Esav is asking, why do you have all this? What's all this about? And in Pasuk Tet, the way Rashi reads this, Esav says, Yesh li rav, I have a lot. Achi, my brother, yehi lecha asher lach, you may have yours. Rashi sees that as Esav finally recanting his position from the end of Toldos. When Esav had said, I'm going to get my brother, I wanted that bracha, and he took it. Now he says, yehi lecha asher lach, you can have yours. I give you this bracha back. Which is what leads Yaakov to then say, no, kachno es birchasi asher huvaslach, take my bracha. It's almost like a hot potato game. He says, you can have the bracha. No, you take the bracha. He's offering it back to Esav. Yaakov, for his part, is suspicious. Yaakov is even hostile, and therefore he insists about the gift. He sees Esav as a threat, and he's aggressive. If you go to Pasuk Yud, where he said, seeing your face is like seeing God, when does Yaakov see God? What does that mean? When did Yaakov ever see the face of God? The answer was never. However, he did see somebody who used this name of Elohim for himself when he fought with the Malach. The Malach says to him, I'm calling you Yisrael, ki sarisa im Elohim v'im anashim, because you battled with Elohim as well as anashim batuchal, and you were successful. And so Rashi says that Yaakov is using shorthand here. Seeing you is like seeing Elohim. Seeing you? Yeah. You know, I fought with an angel a while back, and I was victorious, Esav. So, in case you had any thought about fighting with me, think again. It's a threat, this phrase. That's the way Rashi reads it. It's a threat to Esav of, listen, take the gift, and forget any idea you had about doing battle. That's the way that Rashi reads it. And as far as better luck next time. Thanks for coming for the first part.
No, sorry.
No, that's fine. Okay. In general, if people have to come for part, that's fine. You know, don't. Yep. Good. So the Yaakov then is still suspicious of Esav, which is why he doesn't want to travel with him. And here, Rashi merges two different sources. He says, yes, Yaakov is sort of lying, but he's sort of not lying. If you take a look at source number 2, this is the Medrash from Bereishis Rabba. He says, until I come to my master in Seir. So Rabbi Avohu said, we have reviewed all of Mikra, all of Scripture. We have not found that our ancestor Yaakov ever went to Esav to Mount Seir. So my little analysis of the map is, you know, matches what Rabbi Avohu discovered by reviewing all of Tanakh. Could it be that Yaakov was honest and yet tricked him? Yaakov is known as being honest. Despite everything that happens, we identify Yaakov with Emes. Rather, when would Yaakov come to him? In the future. As it is written, and the Redeemers will ascend Har Tzion to judge the mountain of Esav. So, according to the Medrash, Yaakov is talking about the time of Mashiach. Yeah, I'll get to Seir. It's going to happen. It's just, you know, windy route till we get there. That's one. However, take a look at the Gemara on the flip side. In source number 3. Source number 3 is talking about a Jew who encounters a situation with someone who is not Jewish, where the Jew is potentially vulnerable. You're traveling alone, you encounter someone who may be a threat to you. And so he says, if he asks where he is going, this party asks where he's going, he should expand the path for him. What does expand the path mean? Expand the path means be very vague. You know, it's like that my parents always said, if you're going to call a cab to take you to the airport, you shouldn't give them your address. You should give them, like, the next house down or give them, like, whatever, so that they won't know, oh, this house is empty. Because if someone tries to use that for burglary, they'll come back, they'll see, oh, there are people in that house. You get the idea. It's deception, no? So he says, that's what you should do. Yeah, well, this was their advice. At the time that they gave it to me, it was already, you know, they hadn't had little kids in a while, I think. And so therefore they didn't remember what that's really like. So if he asks where he's going, he should expand the path for him, as our ancestor Yaakov did to wicked Esav, until I come to my master to Seir, and Yaakov traveled to Sukkot. So according to the Gemara, Yaakov is lying. Right? He's not really going there. For good reason. He's saving his life. He's afraid that Esav is going to attack him. It's not cavalier that he does this. Nonetheless, he's saying something untrue. So take a look at what Rashi does in source number 4. Until I come to my master to Seir, he expanded the path for him. He uses the same wording that the Gemara uses. Right? The same wording. Yarchiv lo haderech was the wording in the Gemara. Hirchiv lo haderech. He expanded the path for him. For he intended only to travel to Sukkot. He said, if Esav intends to harm me, he will wait until I come to him. And he did not go. That's all from the Gemara. Then he kicks him with a medrash. When will he go? In the time of Mashiach, and the Redeemers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esav. Because Rashi is bothered by this problem, and he's not satisfied with either solution. Rashi is not satisfied with the idea that Yaakov is saying, well, I'll get there in the time of Mashiach, because it doesn't make any sense. Right? In other words, if someone says to me, just out of the blue, someone who's not my Esav, right, my next door neighbor says, what time are you coming back? And I say to him, oh, I'm coming back in, March, right? And it's my neighbor. I have no reason to lie to him. It's true. I'm coming back a week from now, and then I'm going away, and then I'm coming back again in March. But there's no reason for me to do that.
Has even the concept of Mashiach come to light yet? I mean, that concept has not existed yet.
Right. So it does exist in Yaakov's mind at some point. We don't know when.
Okay.
But we don't know when. In other words, Yaakov says things later in his brachos to the Shvatim, which we understand to be about some future time. And clearly he envisions the formation of a nation when he says, the scepter will never leave Yehuda and things like that. So Yaakov does see this as this kind of image of building a nation going forward. Mashiach specifically at this stage, this would be the first hint of it that we have. Unless you're going to look at somehow the bracha and the bechorah is tying into that. But there's certainly nothing explicit yet. But yeah, the Medrash sees this as his implication. So, Rashi is not satisfied with the Medrash's approach about Mashiach's time because it doesn't explain why Yaakov would have done it. So that's why he throws in the Gemara. But then he's bought with, just to wrap that, he brings in the Gemara, but he's not satisfied with the Gemara either because that makes Yaakov a liar. So, therefore, we need the Gemara and we need the Medrash together to satisfy our read of the Pasuk. Yes, he's deceiving because he feels that there's a need to, but he won't deceive entirely. Shades of what Rashi read into Yaakov earlier, last week's parsha, when Yaakov took the Bechorah, or 2 weeks ago, right? When Yaakov says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha, right? It's me, Esav is your Bechor. Yaakov can't bring himself to say something that's a full lie. He can't bring himself to say something that's completely untrue. And so he says something which will serve the purpose of the moment, while still remaining sort of on the, on that fringe. He hasn't quite had to say something that was false, even though he's justified. He thinks he's saving his life. Yeah.
Is Sukkot in the same direction as Seir, and Seir is just farther, or?
Well, they're all technically in the same direction at this stage. He's heading west. So technically, you have to diverge at some point. But yeah, they're both in the same basic direction.
Can't Seir mean toward Seir? Like, no.
Well, this is Avo El Adoni. Until I come to my master.
But I'll come toward you. I don't know.
Well, then would it satisfy Esav? In other words, Esav had said, I want to be with you. So for him to say, well, I'm going to travel in that general direction towards Seir.
He's saying if he's saying towards Seir, so he's not really lying if he's not planning.
Oh, because he is going to end up. Right, so it's another way in which his statement isn't quite false. That's interesting. Yeah, we have to go look at a map and really see. Seir is to the south, and Sukkot, my impression is more central. But from where Yaakov is, just having entered the land, it could be. I'm not sure. I know. Seir is south. I'm not sure where you put Sukkot. Maybe they're towards the same direction. I don't know. Okay, so that's Rashi's take. The approach, on the other hand, of Ibn Ezra is, number one, the emotion is real. And Ibn Ezra, you have to remember, Ibn Ezra is a worthwhile read if you ever want a good laugh at quality sarcasm. Ibn Ezra says, regarding the drasha about the dots, that it wasn't real or whatever, he says, yeah, you know, that's a good story for children. That's what he writes. He says, yeah, it's nice for atike mishadayim, kids who have just been weaned. He says, that's appropriate for them. He says, of course it's genuine. And he says, I'll prove it to you. Look at the end of Pasuk Dalet. It says, Vayivku, and they cried. That's the same term that the Torah uses when, like, Yosef and his brothers get back together when they find out it's Yosef and all that. He says, that's a term we use for genuine weeping. This is not some kind of a masquerade. Esav is sincere, and Yaakov is fine with him. Yaakov is still concerned about the possibility of battle, and he needs to reiterate his confidence, hey, I survived the battle with a malach. He wants to appease Esav with the gift, but Ibn Ezra is much more willing to accept the idea that Esav is sincere. And so he says Esav really just is curious when he asks these questions. Who are all these people? How did you meet? Where is she from? You know, that sort of thing. Who are these people who escorted the gift? And Yaakov, for his part, just wants to be a part. He's happy that they're now, you know, better than they were. And he'd like to keep it that way. And so he'll say, you live in your place, I live in my place. He does not address, Ibn Ezra does not address why Yaakov says the Seir thing. He doesn't handle that. When you're a Mefarish, when you're a commentator, you get to choose which one you comment on. And he simply ignores the Seir issue. Yeah, maybe. Well, I always tell people, I think I've already said it here even, that it's worthwhile to read Ibn Ezra's introduction to the Chumash. He talks about why write a Perush at all. By his day, you already have many Perushim that have been written down on the Chumash. And he says, what am I adding here? Why am I bothering to write things? And he goes through a whole bunch of different approaches to Parshanut, and he explains where his niche is. But he definitely is not going to say anything unless he feels he's going to contribute something new to the conversation. I jump ahead in time now to contrast Rashi and Ibn Ezra with two more recent commentaries, Malbim and the Nitziv, recognizing that we're running down on time a little bit, but I want to make sure to get some thoughts in from both of them. The Malbim also believes Esav's emotion is real. He says Hashem is the one who made Esav change his heart. Like, Ibn Ezra didn't tackle that. How did Esav change his mind? Ibn Ezra didn't say. Rashi said it's the Malachim. Malbim says God did it. Malbim does not address Yaakov's insistence on calling Esav his master. That evidently doesn't bother him. But the back and forth about the gift, he says Esav is asking the why question. What's your goal in giving me this gift? And this is the way that he reads the back and forth and the change from mincha to bracha. Watch this. In Pasuk Chet, Esav says, why did you send this whole camp that I encountered? And Yaakov says, I wanted to find favor in your eyes. And in Pasuk Tet, Esav says, Yesh li rab, I already have a lot. This isn't a significant gift to me. You thought you were sending me some impressive gift, right? It's like the nightmare reaction that some of my kids have when they get, you know, presents from relatives, right? You never want it to happen, but you just know at least one kid is going to react that way. I don't like that, or I have that, or, you know, dot, dot, dot. I was hoping for I'm glad you all laugh, and it's not just my kids that do that. But that's Esav's reaction. Esav's reaction is, come on, that's not a real gift. Actually, Rav, I have a ton. You know, you can keep that. To which Yaakov says, no, you misunderstand. He says, it's not about it being a lot for you to receive. Lakachta min chasi miyadi. Take my gift from my hand. It's a lot for me to give. It's important not because it'll mean something to you. It's important because it means something to me, like bringing a carbon. Right? It's not about the gift being significant to God, but I'm giving something that matters to me. And that's what he comes back to to Esav. And he says, kachna is bir chasi. Take my bracha, which is really what this is about. It's my good wishes to you. And also, bracha is about things that grow in general. That's a larger discussion, but the word bracha is used in the Torah regarding things that grow and develop. And he's saying, you know, I'm giving you animals, they can grow, they can breed, there'll be a bracha from this. Malbim does not address why Yaakov doesn't want to accompany Esav. However, regarding Seir, he makes an interesting point. He said Esav doesn't stay in Seir. Esav himself doesn't go to Seir. Esav goes to Seir at first, but then he goes back to their father Yitzchak. Because in fact, when Yitzchak dies, we find that Esav is involved in the burial. Now, the truth is that that's not for a while. Yitzchak doesn't die for a very long time. Yitzchak is alive at the time that Yosef is sold. But the idea is, according to Malbim, Yaakov doesn't go to Seir not because he's lying, but because he doesn't need to. He plans to go to Seir, but then he encounters Esav at his father's house, and they live happily ever after. That's the way that that Malbim reads it. Finally, one last approach, and it's the approach of the Nitziv. And the Nitziv's approach is very important because he's dealing with it on a very practical level. Both Malbim and Nitziv are dealing with issues that we face in our own day, dealing with the nations around us. Both of them are post-Enlightenment, emancipation, Jews being able to mix in society. And they're both looking at this very practically in terms of a guide for how we interact. Now, and Ibn Ezra also deals in a mixed society, but it's a different kind in his day. It's a much more religious society and a much more divided religious society for Ibn Ezra. Malbim and Nitziv are looking at this from a much more modern perspective, where everyone expects the Jews to just, get out of the ghetto and interact on a secular level. So both of them address it that way. Malbim addressed it in terms of of Esav's emotion being sincere, and that's I think is the thrust for Malbim, is that Esav throughout this is really, really wants to be close to Yaakov, and Yaakov is still a little standoffish. Nitziv makes the point explicitly. Nitziv says, you know what the story is about? It's about the Jew who is approached by his non-Jewish neighbor, who says to him, come be close to me, we'll be friends, it'll be wonderful. And the Jew being a little standoffish and offending his neighbor. That's the way that the Nitziv reads the story. So he says, Esav, number one, is genuine. He also points to this Vayivku, them crying. And he says, he writes it beautifully. I should have brought it in the Hebrew, but I did not. I didn't type it up. He says, when Esav awakens to recognize us, we awaken back to them. When they show that they love us, then we are willing to love them. And he gives you as an example the partnership between Rebbe and Antoninus, which I brought you in source number 5 from the Gemara in Brachos. Rebbe and Antoninus was a Roman leader, and Rebbe was Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, and this is just a Gemara that talks about how they both were wealthy, but they were close friends. There's a whole story how they became friends, but the point is that he says Esav is genuine, and Yaakov genuinely responds with real emotion to Esav. However, Yaakov knows that in the end he can't be with Esav. Yaakov knows he has to chart his own path, and he's afraid that Esav is going to be offended. He remembers the story of the fight with the Malach and the Gid Hanasha, how the angel is able to hurt him a little bit. And he says, Esav maybe is going to hurt me a little bit also. Maybe that was a hint to me that Esav is going to attack and hurt me a little. So therefore, he says, I want you to take the gift. Esav is sincere, saying, no, I don't need this. It's fine. I don't need your tzedakah. Yaakov is sincere also and says, see me as a servant. There's an interesting interplay there. I didn't point it out when we read it. But in Pasuk Tet, Esav says, you're my brother, right, Achi. And in Pasuk Yud, Yaakov in Pasuk Yud, he says, seeing you is like seeing Elohim. He insists on putting you on a pedestal, Esav. And he wants Esav to be happy. Yaakov, in the end, insists on going it alone because he believes that that's what he's supposed to do. And he's afraid to go to Seir. Because Esav sees this and is annoyed, and Yaakov is worried that there's going to be antagonism in the future, and so Yaakov, yes, simply says, there's no way I'm going to Seir. I'm not going to endanger myself. And that's a path that the Nitziv is prescribing. Remember that the Nitziv deals with this with the Russian government. Right? The Nitziv is the head of the yeshiva in Volozhin, and the Russians come in, and they say to him, you can't have a yeshiva that's focused entirely on Jewish studies. You have to bring in professors who have degrees from Russian institutions. You have to teach secular studies a certain number of hours a day. And the Nitziv, at first, gives in. He's willing to accommodate a little bit until finally he feels that they've just destroyed the meaning of the yeshiva at all, and he closes the doors. There's some historical debate. The historians debate whether it was the Nitziv's decision in the end or the government's decision in the end when he refused certain things, but it comes down to the same thing. he understands that on the one hand, we need to be open to them. On the other hand, we can't sabotage who we are. And he sees that in the story of Esav and Yaakov, which to me is a fascinating thing, because you go from Rashi and Ibn Ezra looking at it just this sort of framework of Esav dealing with Yaakov, and then suddenly it becomes a story that's a guideline for the way Jews are going to relate to their neighbors down through the ages. So, yeah, when I initially prepared this, I thought I would do a summary at the end, and I realized that this is a nightmare to summarize. So that's why I did the table. Because hopefully you'll be able to look at the table, and that will carry enough of the what we've said. Okay. Well, thank you very much. God willing, next week, 10 o'clock.